This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Very best bits of today's show. 28th of July, Wednesday, lovingly curated as ever by producer Shruti Rajendran. Hey, Shruts.
Hello.
So we've got Serena first up on COVID news, Olympic news and all things in between. Then our interview with Peter England of Rack Bank. The banking sector is doing well, isn't it?
Yes, and it's positive because he said it's not just Rack Bank who's doing well, but he says across the sector there's been a growth. So interesting, good times for the UAE.
Yeah, so we had Peter on this morning about 7:30 on the show on Wednesday morning. Their results came out late yesterday afternoon, and the 25% increase in profits are good numbers. But he said, I think it is across the sector, it's not just us. And then about half an hour after he was on the show, boom, 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 we got numbers from Emirates NBD, FAB and Dubai Islamic Bank. And they're all up about 15-18% profitability. It's not doubling like Apple, but it's good, solid set of numbers. Also doing well is the luxury goods sector. Now, this is Michael Shaloub of the Shaloub Group. We wanted to get Michael on because a couple of days ago, wasn't it, LVMH numbers came out, the French luxury goods company.
Yeah.
And they were great, weren't they?
Yeah.
Really, really good. They said from China to America, everyone's buying Louis Vuitton, Dior, posh stuff. And we thought, are they doing it here? So Shaloub Group is the regional partner distributor for a bunch of these brands, Vuitton, Dior, Kenzo, and so on. And he said yes. He said sales are better than pre-pandemic, which is interesting, and he'll explain why a little bit later on. Finally, Tom's interview with the guys from uDrive was good.
Yes, I love that interview. I'm a uDrive user. I always use it, you know, when I give my car for servicing and I need a way to get home. I don't want to pay for a taxi, especially during the pandemic. I didn't want to do it. So I always take a uDrive and then drive home and then just leave it. And that's it. So I'm a huge supporter of uDrive. And it's really great to see that they're doing well. And also they've got, was it 500 million US dollars or 5 million?
5 million.
5 million, sorry.
Easy.
I would give them 500 million. I'm kidding. 5 million US dollars in funding. And we obviously asked them, what is it going to be used for?
Which is all well and good. First up, though, here's Serena with the big stories.
Ask Serena.
Morning, Mrs. K.
Morning, guys.
Right there, let's talk about Abu Dhabi, the nation's capital, where you're from.
Yes.
There's been a reminder on why one needs a movement permit.
Yes. Abu Dhabi authorities are reminding us, if you do not have your movement permit to move about the capital during the national disinfection timings, it is a 3,000 dirham fine. Currently, national disinfection timings are between midnight and 5 a.m. every day. You should be indoors during this time. If you do need to be out and about, you need to apply for a permit, a movement permit, which can be found on the Abu Dhabi Police website, adpolice.gov.ae. The permit is for essential purposes only, such as if you're heading out to purchase groceries, food, medicine, doctor's appointment, those type of things. If you do not have a permit and you are out without approval, you will be fined. And again, it is 3,000 dirhams.
Doesn't it take you back to April last year, mm-hmm. when here in Dubai you needed a permit for pretty much everything? And we were all, I guess, relatively lucky in that we got to come to work every day.
Yeah.
And we got out the house. But you, I know you in particular, because you came in earlier than, you came in about an hour and a half earlier than most of us.
Yeah, before the timings, because I think it was like up until 6 a.m. every morning. And obviously we were all in before that time. But obviously during the rules and regulations then was if you had notification from your company that you were legally allowed, you know, it was essential work purposes like doctors, nurses, media, that type of thing, then you were exempt. It was okay. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You did need a movement permit. You had to apply and it would come through SMS. And yeah, you needed to show that when you were entering the supermarket.
Did any of us ever get stopped? I'm just imagine the police stopping you at 4 o'clock in the morning. What are you doing on the roads? I'm an essential worker. What do you do? Nurse, doctor, radio presenter.
Yeah.
You? Essential? come. I mean, we were local media, joking apart, were down as being providing an essential service. But I never got stopped. Did you?
I did once coming did in, and I think because it was the same police patrol car that would be out every morning during the time I was coming in, and there was one point they had stopped near a traffic light, and I wound down my window, and they were just confirming. And as soon as I said the company I worked for, I think because we'd been on air for so, you know, covering the pandemic and providing so much information, they just kind of waved me on, and I was like, thank you very much for everything you do.
Yeah. And by the way, I've got a question for you.
Yes.
No, that's what they said
to
you.
Oh, right, yeah, that. I was like, wait, what? Yeah, exactly. Serena.
Did you get pulled over, Tom?
No.
I remember you got flashed a couple of times, and I'm talking by radars.
Yes,
because you were concerned about being fined, because obviously you do have the radars in Abu Dhabi now that will flash you with regards to being out during national disinfection times
As things turned out, I couldn't tell whether I had been fined or not, because I got so many parking fines down there, it doesn't matter.
Tom! Oh,
they all
dear.
Added up. No, I didn't. I didn't get stopped at any point.
What else do we know?
The old Starsky and Hutch.
Yeah.
Flashing light up on top. Straight in.
Should we look at some international stories?
Yes, we can do.
Because you've got Australia extending lockdown in Sydney, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. So New South Wales has extended the COVID-19 lockdown in Sydney. It is for another month. Mm. Lockdown rules were due to end on Friday. So they're trying to control cases of the Delta variant there. A total of 177 new locally acquired cases were detected in New South Wales, and up from 172 a day earlier. Meanwhile, health officials in Russia, they've given the go-ahead for a test that will combine the AstraZeneca jab with their Sputnik V vaccine. So 150 volunteers are going to be involved in a small study set to finish March next year. So it's basically looking at just how safe it is mixing the vaccines and how well the combination triggers immune responses. But this is just one of the very many studies that are ongoing internationally with regards to trying to see, you know, the benefits of mixing certain vaccines. But AstraZeneca, Pfizer studies there have shown very positive results so far. And then you have UK aviation firms are putting pressure on the UK government to allow fully vaccinated travellers from the EU to skip quarantine. So ministers are reviewing England's coronavirus travel restrictions today. Reports indicate they're likely to approve the change, hopefully. You've got airlines such as British Airways, Virgin Atlantic. They've been involved in a pilot program and insist it can be done safely and efficiently. And it would also apply to visitors arriving from the United States.
Yeah, the US is interesting because you've been listening into one of their press briefings, haven't you?
Yes. So it was Jen Psaki's relayed this advice from American officials.
The CDC just advised Americans against travel to the United Kingdom this past Monday, given the surge in cases. They will evaluate and make recommendations based on health data.
Yeah, so it's one to watch today for you. We'll be keeping across that for you at the Aaron News Centre.
Quick update on the Olympics, if you would, please.
So the current medal tally, you've got Japan leading with a total of 20, 11 gold.
Told you.
United States of America, 29 with 10 gold. And China, 23, 10 gold there. The Russian Olympic Committee, they've got 19 with 7 gold. Australia bringing up in fifth, total of 15 medals, 6 of those gold. And Great Britain then bringing also 15 with 5 gold. Do you remember, Tom, you were talking about the cycling event with the unknown.
Anna
Van Vleuten.
She was the one.
So Austria's Anna Kissenhofer. Yep, won the women's cycling road race, an unknown. And you had Anna Meek van Vleuten, who crossed in second.
That's right.
She was celebrating and then only to realise she wasn't actually first. This time there was no mistake. She is an Olympic champion because she just took gold in the time trial, winning by 56 seconds over 22 kilometres. Mm. Boost for the Dutch team. And she actually joked as she crossed. She was like, I am number one, right? The finish, yeah. So that was a nice reprieve, I suppose.
Nice.
Redemption.
Sense of humour. I like that.
Yep. And then Tokyo, just on the COVID front there, they're asking hospitals just to prepare more beds for COVID-19 patients because their daily infections in the city have doubled. Yeah, so it's just...
Well, across the city?
They're saying the city have doubled to 1,429 on Monday from a week earlier. So it's the highest number for a Monday since the pandemic began. But yeah, they just want to make more beds available in the hospitals.
Serena Kelly, thank you very much indeed.
More details on the Erin News Centre app.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
One stock we will be watching at the Bell in Abu Dhabi today is Rackbank, because earnings were out yesterday and they were good. A 25% increase in quarterly profit. New loans were up, bad loans were down. Good news for any bank. Joining us on the line now is the Chief Executive, Peter England. Morning, Peter.
Good morning, Richard. How are you?
I'm really good. Thanks very much indeed. It's always good to see UAE companies doing well. And Rackbank had a good set of numbers yesterday. 25% increase in profitability. What was the story behind that number?
Yeah, look, I think, Richard, you know, banking, particularly our type of business, is very much a trend-driven business. It's not like your friends at Apple, where we go and launch a new iPhone and have a bumper quarter or whatever it may be. So, you know, I think what's really important is that we have seen that, you know, we've had sort of five quarters now of our net interest income declining, mainly because of obviously a very low, you know, lackluster loan demand and obviously credit concerns and so on. And, you know, what's important here is we've finally seen that flatten out. So in Q2, we actually saw a slight increase in net interest income, which means that sort of trend of five quarters of decline has now stopped. We also had a very good, strong quarter in terms of fee income. You know, actually during COVID, fee income for banks generally and Rackbank particularly has actually been very, very strong. And we had another great quarter in terms of non-interest income.
Just very quickly define that for me in layman's terms.
Yeah, so non-interest income basically would be fees from things like wealth management, our treasury operations, FX, you know, foreign exchange for our SME clients, our retail clients, and so forth. So anything that's basically a straight-up fee income. So that is a little bit more variable. And we also have quite a large proprietary book in our treasury where we, you know, buy and sell bonds in, for our own account, so to speak. So they're the sorts of things that tend to drive fee income. So if you put the two of those together, our income grew quite solidly by about 30-odd million. And, of course, the big delta was provisions dropping very, very sharply. And again, that's a trend. You know, it's not something that just happens suddenly. It's something that you see gradually improving asset quality through a number of reasons. And in our case, it's really twofold. One is that we see the overall economy being, you know, much, much better than it was particularly a year ago, for obvious reasons. And also, you know, we've quite significantly changed our business mix. I mean, Rackbank has always been a relatively higher risk, higher return lender. We do a lot of, as you know, we're the largest small business bank in the country. So, you know, we do a lot of things that are a little bit higher risk than perhaps some of the other banks do. And, you know, we've gradually changed the dynamics of our book over the last few years and particularly over the last year. So that change of mix also is reducing provisions for the bank.
Okay, there's a lot to unpick there. So let's look at each of them in turn. The reduction in bad loans is clearly a good thing. Is this a Rackbank thing or is this something that you think is happening across the sector? And if so, why?
No, look, I think we are seeing it across the sector because, you know, clearly I think, you know, the UAE has done such a great job, particularly around, you know, vaccinations and really getting the economy moving again. So, yeah, the general sense we get from our, you know, from our own numbers, from our smaller clients, even from our bigger clients, is that things are much, much better. Certainly, you know, segments such as retail, you know, we were talking to a very large retailer a few days ago, and they were telling us, you know, their sales are absolutely booming. And, you know, I hear you talking about, you know, the car business, for example, this morning. You know, real estate is blindingly obvious that it's doing exceptionally well in the UAE at the moment, particularly residential real estate. So I think, you know, that broad sort of economic improvement is significant. And as I said, the second thing for us is that, you know, now we lend to a much more diverse group of clients. You know, we have a large corporate lending book. We have a large lending book where we lend to money to banks outside of the UAE, for example. So, you know, we have a lot more diversification, and those things are absolutely helping improve our bad debt provisions.
Well, when it comes to retail spending, stick around, Peter, because in about 20 minutes' time, we're going to be talking to Michael Shaloub of Shaloub Group, they of Louis Vuitton, Ralph Lauren, Dior, Fendi, etc., about what's happening in that segment of the market. But in terms of people who are borrowing, the increase in loans was not huge. It was 3 and a bit percent, I think, increase in assets or increase in lending. Is that right, Peter?
That's right, yeah. And look, I think that's not unexpected. We are still seeing relatively sluggish loan demand in certain sectors. And again, the small business one is probably one that, we did no business last year for 5 months. So, we had a significant decline pretty much in that. And it wasn't, to a large extent, our choice. It was a lot of cases people didn't want to borrow money. We're now back at, for our SME lending specifically, we're probably at about 70% of where we were pre-COVID. So, we've gone from, 100 to zero to back up to about 65, 70 a month. And, even in July with Eid and so forth, our numbers are actually pretty solid. So, the demand is coming back, but it's not at pre-COVID levels yet.
And what are people borrowing money for? Is it up in your hinterland, Ras Al Khaimah, in the rat-free trade zone, which we drive through on the way to those swanky hotels to build a new widget factory? Or is it trade? Is it trade finance? What are those loans?
Yeah, look, for us, our business, despite being the National Bank of Ras Al Khaimah, is largely, particularly in the SME side, obviously Dubai is where most of the action is. So, yes, we do lend to free zone companies, for example, in Ras Al Khaimah, but it's predominantly SMEs in Dubai. Trading is a very, very big part of that. Retail, it's a very diverse group of clients, but trading absolutely is one of the largest. Now, for trade finance, for example, we have different types of products. One of the more traditional type of trade products, and others are just simple lending for people to buy a container of, chairs or whatever they're going to sell. So it's just across the board, really, that we're seeing it.
It's good to see a bank like RakBank having profitability increasing. It's good for the country, which is good. To what extent, though, I was wondering this morning, to what extent is this the central bank and the TESS program, the targeted economic support scheme that was put in place just over a year ago, propping up the banks? And to what extent are they standing on their own 2 feet now?
Now it's not the central bank propping up the banks at all. I think, what was done by the central bank at the time was absolutely superb. It was essential to not only help the banking industry, but help the economy generally, to allow banks to defer loan repayments for clients. What we're seeing now, we've had practically zero requests for new loan deferrals. We still have some active ones from last year, but we have basically no new requests this year at all. So now it's really very much business as usual. In fact, the TESS program from this month is gradually being wound back with the banks. And by year end, there's a small extension for part of it goes into the second half of next year. But the main source of funding for TESS will be repaid during the course of this year to the central bank. So no, that's really not a factor now. As I said at the time, it was just huge. Without it, it would have been a very different equation to what we're talking about today, but not now.
Finally, Peter, let me ask you about one of Tom's big talking points this morning, which is work from home. We heard about it in the UAE medical press conference last night. I was actually in Dubai Silicon Oasis last night, picking my sons up from a friend's house, and I drove past your headquarters, and I was thinking, I wonder how many people are going to work in there on a daily basis. How are you balancing as a CEO of a fairly large organization, work from home versus work from the office versus work from anywhere?
Yeah, so look, what we did about 4 months ago, I asked my management team specifically to come back to the office. Some didn't like it particularly, but everyone's back now. At sort of our more mid-level and sort of more junior level staff, we try to operate at about 60% capacity, just simply to ensure as much social distancing as possible. But yeah, again, if you go back 6-9 months, there was no one in the office. Now we're at about 60% capacity. And we just sort of rotate this, and we just make sure that people have plenty of space and that we're keeping people as safe as possible. But it's good to have people back. I think productivity is definitely improving, in our case at least, with people back in the office.
Peter, great talking to you. Appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much indeed. That is Peter England. He's the chief executive of Rackbank. Overnight, they reported a 25% increase in quarterly profit. You're listening to The Business Breakfast, Dubai i103.8.
Catch up on the business headlines with The Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Well, we're talking about the finance of fashion. And that is because earlier on this week, it is earnings season right now, LVMH, the French luxury goods giant, reporting a 14% increase in its profitability, not against last year, but against 2019 pre-pandemic. It says demand is booming from China to the United States. But what's the situation here in the Middle East? Well, the Chalhoub Group is the representative for a number of luxury fashion brands here in the UAE. Looking on their website this morning, it's quite a list, Thomas Urquhart. And this is not an exhaustive list. Louis Vuitton, Ralph Lauren, Sephora, Dior, Fendi, Kenzo, and Lacoste. Michael Chalhoub from the Chalhoub Group joins us on the line right now. Morning, Michael.
Good morning, Richard. How are you?
Really good. Thanks very much indeed. Really keen to find out what's happening here in the Middle East. And I'm going to caveat that before we start by saying you do not work for LVMH. It's a listed company in France, so you're not a spokesperson for them, but you are a spokesperson for the Chalhoub Group, a luxury goods company here in the UAE. So with that said, to keep the lawyers happy, what are you seeing on the ground here? Is the global boom in luxury goods sales happening in the Middle East?
Yes, I mean, we can feel that. More than that, I would say that the luxury market has recovered even faster in the GCC than in the rest of the world. We've seen a lot of sectors suffer in the Middle East, sectors like hospitality or FMCG. But it's true that with luxury, we're not feeling the same way. We're feeling like there's a lot of willingness to be able to suit ourselves in the best of ways and to make the most out of the lives that we're living. And so the global luxury market is deemed to recover by 2022. In the GCC, what we felt is 2021 has already been back to normal levels. So we're talking about beauty, which is plus 1% in prestige beauty versus 2019. But we're also talking about fashion, which is rising at an even higher pace than 2019.
Well, so beauty is better than 2019, only just by 1%. What would you say that percentage is for fashion versus 2019?
About 6 to 7%. But it really depends on affordable, aspirational or high-end fashion. And what we've really noticed is that there's a very strong performance on high-end and absolute luxury brands, including jewelry, but also very high-end fashion, much more than premium fashion brands.
Well, I mean, one man's premium and one man's high-end is a very different thing. If we're looking at the, I think you called it the very high-end, what would be a typical ticket size for a purchase there? Are we talking in dirham terms, thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps even more than that?
Well, the average ticket size can go from 4,000 all the way to 6,000-7,000 dirhams. We've seen that there's definitely a number of consumers that that are willing and wanting to spend those amounts. Definitely tourists have come back to Dubai. And even though we've only welcomed about one third of the normal amount of tourists, we've also welcomed them for longer periods of time and usually tourists with higher incomes. It might not be the same types of tourists that we used to welcome, probably less people coming from China, from India, from Saudi Arabia, but much more affluent Europeans, Russians, even Africans that have been coming. And then on top of that, we've had a very strong local consumption with a repatriated consumption. We've seen a lot of local Emiratis, local Saudis spend in their own countries rather than spend abroad like some of them used to. We've estimated that about one third to half of their consumption was based abroad in London, Paris, Geneva, Istanbul, and now it's concentrating more and more in their home countries.
So let's talk about how people are shopping. Even before the pandemic, Michael, we'd spoken to you and your colleague Patrick about the pivot towards e-commerce, towards online, and there was a big focus for you and your organization and others like yours in doing that. What have you seen during the pandemic?
Well, a huge rise of e-commerce, obviously, with high expectations that are increasing very fast in terms of customer experience, user experience, same-day delivery, last-mile delivery. But in general, what we've seen is even more so in 2021, but also in 2020, nearly doubling sales in e-commerce for prestige beauty, for high-end fashion, plus 96% in the GCC, plus 138% in the UAE.
Plus 138%?
In 2021 versus 2019, yes.
Okay, that's quite a leap, isn't it? But in terms of your bricks and mortar stores, because, I mean, the Chalut Group's been around for more than half a century in this region now, and those flagship, those expensive stores in good locations, in premium shopping malls with a very expensive fit-out has always been a big part of what you've done. Does that store still have a future? Are those stores still generating enough money to justify those rents, to justify the staff, to justify the fit-out fees?
What we see from our data is that there's a really new type of customer that's coming along, which is a hybrid customer. And those are the most prominent types of customers, people that want both the offline experience and the online purchases. And so these hybrid consumers are buying much more than the consumers that are buying only from stores or only from e-commerce. And what we need to do is keep the customer at the center of everything that we do and cater to her in the best of ways. And that's what we're trying to do. And I think it's the right balance to have a certain amount of brick and mortar stores and to have a fully functional, great experience online.
But how do you make sure that if I do that, if I walk into one of your expensive stores in all of the Emirates or Riyadh, that I don't then go and buy the product on the Selfridges website and get it shipped over here?
Well, at the end of the day, I think that if we bring value to the customer, wherever they tend to buy the product, we'll be there to gain. So obviously, we'll try to better understand how to cater to that person best. And if it's a price problem, if it's an assortment problem, then we'll try to cater to some of these problematics even better and better. However, at the end of the day, what we're after is pleasing our customer because we want that customer to be loyal to us. We try to find the best of ways to do that, even if that means finding those products, even for her, online on different variety of websites.
And you've got this deal with Farfetch, I think you did quite recently, didn't you, which I guess is part of that. 10 seconds on that?
Yeah, we have a joint venture with Farfetch in the region, and we've allowed ourselves to take the stock that our customer requires from a variety of different stores, both within the region and outside the region,
Michael,
and make
we're
sure
out of time.
That we cater to her.
We're going to have to leave it there. Fascinating conversation. Appreciate your time this morning. Michael Chalut of the Chalut Group talking to us about the rise in luxury goods sales.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
Right, time now for us to talk to the team from Udrive, the Dubai-based Udrive. They've just closed a $5 million fundraising round as the mobility startup expands its fleet ahead of Expo 2020. We're going to chat up to now to the Managing Director of Udrive, Nicholas Watson, joins us live on the live. And happy to say live on Microsoft Teams this morning. Good morning to you, Nicholas.
Nice to meet you. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Great to have you on board. Now, first and foremost, before we dive into the numbers and where the money's come from, etc., talk to me about the sort of changing face of uDrive. Not so much the company, but more your customers. I mean, you brought something new to market back in 2016, certainly here for the region when it comes to fractionalized mobility and the rent by the minute concept. Since 2016, have customers here become more accepting, more understanding, more educated of the concept?
Yeah, I think when we started the business, we had to explain to everybody what we were doing and how we do it. And over the last 2 to 3 years, I think everybody's become more conscious of the fact you don't need to rent something for the whole day or the whole month if you don't need to use it all that amount of time. So I think you see in the cars on the road, you see them everywhere. There's lots of green cars. People become more and more conscious about it. And so it's a lot easier now to sell the concept of using a car for a minute or for an hour, depending on what your use case is.
We often hear and we see data to back up the fact that, you know, we live in a very digitally savvy part of the world with a young population in the whole as well. Has that helped?
Yeah, you know, globally, the whole world is shifting from owning something anyway, whether that's owning a house or owning a car or owning any sort of hardware. Because of that general transfer and then the younger generation not wanting to necessarily put all their money down to own something, it's becoming a lot easier for us to produce a service that is more on demand and only when you need it, you use it. And of course, because we're from anywhere to everywhere, you can effectively drive from your house to the mall and or to a shopping area or anywhere else in Dubai or the UAE and just leave the car and get on with the rest of your day and not have to worry about that asset sitting there.
I mentioned data there as well. Data is so important to your business, to the world in general at the moment. What are the sort of stats? What's the data telling you in terms of number of people that have used the service recently and the trips that you have conducted?
Yeah, so we see a large proportion of our customer base coming in the 25 to 35 year bracket. Mind you, we have a little gap after that, and then you sort of get a peak of 42 to 48 year olds. So you can see that the audience isn't just younger generations. It is the older generation who are probably more aware of why pay for something I don't need. And then our trips are also voluming up because we see a lot of people that don't necessarily want to keep an asset anymore and they just want to have a car for 1 or 2 days or for an hour or two. And so we're seeing more shifts in the ages of the users in our customer base, and we're seeing more mobility from certain areas of Dubai to other areas of Dubai, and then of course across border between the Emirates when the borders are open, we get a lot of transport as well across there.
I think it's fascinating the use of the word empowerment as well in your press. You talk about how you've empowered over 250,000 UAE members or users, if you like. Is that the case? Do you think it is a sort of a means of empowerment?
Yeah, you know, you can drink water. A right to water, a right to food is considered a life thing, right? But mobility is just as important. You stand on your two legs all day. You have to move from one place to another. So mobility is a right. And the way we consider it and the way we're building our products is to enable everybody to have the right to mobility, whether that's you driving the car or your friends driving the car. And that's our big vision, is to ensure that everybody has the ability to move in a car or in one of the other vehicle types we'll be launching. So yeah, we do empower people because we give the people who normally couldn't buy a car or don't want to put big deposits down in rental car, traditional industry players. They don't want to put all that money up front and lock it away for a month or two. So we really empower them to be able to move for a minute and pay only for that minute and have no other burdens placed on them.
Right, that was the buttering up. And now the age-old question that you expected was coming, which is, of course, $5 million US has been raised in the latest round. Where's the money come from and where's it going?
Okay, so the money's come from a couple of locations. We have some investors that were in the press release, which were announced. They've been part of some very large scaled up businesses in the past. There are some other investors we can't name right now, but we'll definitely be in contact when we can. And then, of course, we have our crowdfunded investors as well who have been part of this round. So you know, we're a sharing economy company. We think we've done a really good job of sharing the opportunity to invest in the business amongst traditional investors who know bigger tickets and then smaller ticket investors. Again, empowering people with the opportunity to be part of the uDrive story. It's going to be spent on technology. It's going to be spent on growth. We're going to Saudi Arabia, Turkey, a lot of the GCC market. And if it wasn't for COVID, we'd already be there. However, we are back on our feet and we are ready to go.
Morning, Nicholas. Richard here. You've articulated well the concept for this sector of the mobility industry, the very short-term rental business, 15 minutes. I was looking at your website today. I can rent a car for as little as 60 fils an hour and 60 fils a minute in Sharjah at the moment. But the other dynamic is that it's competitive. I remember 3 or 4 years ago when two licenses were issued here for companies doing this. It was yourselves and there was eCar. And it will get more competitive going forward. So while I'm sold on the general concept of this short-term business rental model, what are going to be the competitive dynamics, the kind of Coke versus Pepsi in this industry? Because for me as a consumer, you look very, very similar. Where are the areas where you can compete and differentiate yourselves?
Yeah, I think the differentiation is in the product mix of the cars, the placement of the cars themselves, because it's on demand. When you wake up in the morning, you look for a car, you hope to find a car on the street, right? And that is the big aim, making sure that the car is there when you need it. And differentiation really boils down to brand and the positioning of the brand. We have a very, very customer-focused positioning. We try to reduce
everybody
all
would say that, Nicholas. No company in your business would say we don't have a customer focused approach, would they?
No, they don't. But the ratings would say otherwise. And I think it also boils down to the customer experience in the mobile app itself, right? That we're designed literally to do one thing: put a car right where the customer needs it and be there for them. We are all our own technology, especially during COVID, where all our cars pay for the parking automatically. We include the fuel in the service. We allow you to drive to many of our locations. Some of our competitors don't allow. And we have some nice fleet choices like the Mustangs that enable you to have an aspirational trip as much as a functional trip from going from a supermarket to your house. There are a lot of things we will be announcing in the next couple of months that will be as part of the enablement of anybody being able to move anywhere they want. There'll be a lot of dynamic fleet changes. But I think in the end, it really boils down to keeping it as low cost as possible and getting rid of the hidden fees. And I think that's one of the key secrets to why uDrive is leading the charge on this.
Nick, we've got 30 seconds left on this one.
Yeah.
Last word has to go to Expo 2020 as well. All eyes on that. Is all the team at uDrive looking forward to it?
Yeah, bring it on. We're super excited. We're ramping up the fleet. We're ready to go. We hope it all happens perfectly and we'll be there ready for it.
Good on you. Good to chat to you this morning. Nicholas Watson is the managing director of uDrive. They're celebrating that latest round of fundraising. $5 million as the mobility startup expanding its fleet ahead of Expo 2020. Nick saying, bring it on. They're ready for it as well. And they're not afraid of work from home as well. We're hybrid work models that we've been discussing actually working in their favour at present.
Just realised I got my car wrapped in green about 3 months ago. I'm going to get people park in the marina. They're just going to walk
it's
in
gone.
And drive off.
It's gone. It's gone, Rich.
Someone's taken it to Spinnies.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.